Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
And with the Media Project, you get an opportunity to hear some commentary, analysis, and if you're lucky, some insight into the media issues of the week. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Rosemary Armeo from UAlbany.
Hello.
Hello. Longtime distinguished investigative journalist, she is. And Dr. Alan Shartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio, columnist, commentator, general man about the place. Good day, sir. It's a wonderful thing.
Uh-oh.
It's a bad wonderful start. Thing to be here. It's a bad we should start over again. So you were saying, apropos of nothing, of course, in this introduction, about knowing when to leave. And maybe Bob Woodward has, are you saying that you think he has failed to do
that? Well, we spoke about Mr. Woodward last week. He had an interesting fight with the White House. He exchanged emails with Gene Sperling, a White House aide, about Woodward's writing on the budget crisis. And they got into a spat. The next day, Mr. Sperling apologized, but not before Woodward had turned this into a federal case, saying the White House was attacking reporters. And the Washington Post picked that up on his behalf.
And I have to say, Rosemary, if I may, that I was watching Morning Joe.
Yes.
And they had this group of guys, including Sperling, including Woodward there. And it sounded to me like Woodward had to run backwards and really had not been threatened in any way.
He has not. And he's long been known to be extremely sensitive of his reputation. And it goes overboard. That seems to be what happened. But what also happened was Slate ran a big piece. I've sent it to all my colleagues in the journalism school. It gets at the heart of accuracy and truth. An author went back and re-reported the book that Woodward did on John Belushi, the comedian who, you know, killed himself with drugs. And repeatedly, the same thing happened there that happened in the recent dust-up. He would accurately report words. He got the words down accurately. But all of the meaning and import was incorrect. So one example was he talked to a director about how amazing an improvisational artist Belushi was, that you just, his director would yell out a suggestion and he would immediately turn it into a physical prank, and he was hysterical. In the Belushi book that Woodward did, he turned that into a sign of how undisciplined Belushi was, that he had to constantly be given directives by his director. So as Slate wrote, it was right, but it was wrong.
Good at
really
stenography,
wrong.
Bad at interpretation and analysis.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and I mean, it just so matches with this latest dust-up. So then we got talking about maybe Woodworth has just made enough enemies that they're looking at things
could be
way
the knives are out.
Closely.
This is possible, too. It's hard to tell.
I feel that myself sometimes, even when I talk to my best friends. like Rex.
Hard to tell.
Okay, but I have to say that I was very struck. I know a state legislator who told me he was speaking to the now in jail Speaker of the Massachusetts House. And the guy looked at him and said, well, I just stayed too long.
That could be. You know, it is interesting, I think, that when the president went to the Gridiron Dinner the other night, he made a crack about this.
Yes.
And everybody got it instantly. He said, I never knew how threatening Gene Sperling was. And everybody on the inside who knows him laughed because Sperling is a little guy who's kind of a bit of a nebbish. And,
but
so
a sweet man.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And so the thought that he could threaten Big Bob Woodward is kind of
Well,
humorous.
I mean, you just look. You don't have to know either of them. You just look at the exchange, which has now been made public. And it's so, he just, Woodward looks silly.
But of course, Woodward and Bernstein are names. I mean, they are the names in investigative journalism. They may not be the best investigative journalist, but they are the guys who everybody modeled their careers after, and every kid went into journalism school because they wanted to be an investigative reporter. But you're an investigative reporter, and Rosemary, and I just wonder whether or not this has hurt them just by being the icons.
No, their work stands as just exemplary in Watergate. It's the way to do an investigation. And Woodward since then has done some amazing books. Veil and the Brethren turned a light on the Supreme Court and the CIA that we have never had. Mm-hmm. He really did. He's a monumental figure in investigative reporting. But, you know, he just has his personality quirk.
He will say,
under control now.
You know, he came to visit the Times Union a couple of years ago because he wanted to see, he was, I believe, here speaking. He was speaking not too far away, and he wanted to see Harry Rosenfeld, our editor at large,
who was the
assistant managing editor.
Right?
It was Martin Balsam.
Martin Balsam in the movie. And, and it was really quite moving when they saw each other in the lobby of the Times Union, embraced for the first time in years. And I went to ask him in our staff forum as he was speaking if there was a lesson he could give reporters about the necessity to really keep digging, that is to keep pursuing a story. And I wanted to ask him, you know, there are those who say that you get access to things because you're Bob Woodward, but your record reveals that you really do meticulous reporting,
right?
Which it does. If you look at his work, there is a lot of hard digging in that. But I didn't even get the question out because I said, there are those who say that you get access because you're Bob Woodward.
And he
boy, did he
jumped.
Leap upon
yeah,
that.
He has always been known to have a really thin skin. As for my suggestion of who are the best investigative reporters of our time, I'd pick Bartlett and Steele, the Philadelphia Inquirer, an amazing team who have tackled the hardest issues, including tax and oil profits. And
written
remarkable.
It in an accessible way so that it could
absolutely.
Really be understandable.
And one of their famous pieces, it was actually their editor who helped with the show. I always need an editor, Rex. They're telling the story.
Sometimes you need an editor. Sometimes you'd be better off without them.
That's the prevailing view of we journalists. But they were writing about, you know, redistribution of wealth, kind of a big and abstract topic. And it's begun, it's written like a fairy tale, once upon a time, because the more complicated the material, the simpler the structure and format should be. They're brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill Marimot, too, also in the Philadelphia.
But this is still inside
days.
Baseball for a lot of us who have not
I
heard
know.
These names.
Yeah. I know.
I used to work for a legendary investigative editor named Bob Green at Newsday. And Green used to say, and I didn't actually know the reference, but he kept saying, you got to write this in Dicky Dare style. Now, Dicky Dare was apparently a novel for boys.
Yeah.
And Dicky Dare would always have these little adventures, but it was really almost childish language. And he would say, this is not Dicky Dare enough. And you would have to simplify, even though you would have gone through months and months of work to produce something. He wanted Dicky Dare style.
Well, this is a writing lesson, so I guess applicable to everybody. But if you don't understand something completely, totally inside and out, you can't write it simply and accessible. You use big words and a fusticade and add lots of dependent clauses so that it gets as complicated and dense in the writing as the topic.
Legislature does that all the time. No, I'm sure
it's
that
true.
They have created their own language so that only they can understand it. First reading, second reading, third reading, you know, lay it aside and all like that.
You know, one of the challenges in the environment that we're talking about in the reporting in Washington, for example, is to do more than stenography. And this has often been a criticism of the White House press corps, that all they're doing in that environment where there are very high-profile reporters is simply repeating back what the White House gives them. And it is a great frustration for a lot of the reporters. And so sometimes they seek to differentiate themselves by going a little bit on a limb, by doing the term in theology would be eisegesis rather than exegesis. They're putting stuff into the text rather than taking it out. Did you like that, how I threw that in with, you know,
well,
in the context
that
of
Rex's
the election before.
Father and his brother were both
in the context
clergy.
Of the Pope getting elected and so on. This is a big deal. But
well, let me ask
it's
you about
terrible
that.
The media is ignoring that, isn't it?
Yeah. Boy, I've never seen it. The Daily News and the New York POST, a name I don't like to pronounce out loud, had page after page after page after page on the election of the Pope. How much of that, I wonder, becomes we have to show every group that we are for them, and so they'll read our newspaper. In other words, how much of that is
I think
just...
that's it? Really?
Don't no,
you
I don't, think I'm, that... No, oh. I asked it as a question.
Oh.
Yes, I think it's it. Yes, I think it's it.
Okay, I just have to tell a joke here first. Dawn Fallick, who used to work with Rex, now teaches at the University of Delaware.
And what's her name again?
Dawn Fallick, yes. Mm-hmm. That Fallick? Is her name. She gets many jokes on that.
I knew a guy named Louis Fallick. Right?
Could have been related.
She had a wonderful post on Facebook, and she said, I can't remember the last time we Jews made a big deal like this. Moses, A, you know, you split the sea, those seven plagues. Where's the food? I love that.
Yeah.
I told that to my mother, who it's a big Catholic.
But it's kind of amazing. I mean, the gathering of reporters in advance, the discussion about the difficulty of making black smoke versus white smoke, and the insulation of the chimney. There is a lot of coverage. But now, doesn't a pope really make a difference? I mean, so it is a big deal.
Yes, okay. But the real question is the press doing its job? So, for example, in Argentina, there has been some real bad blood, apparently, between the president on subjects like gay marriage and some of the other things,
yes,
and the Pope.
Right.
I kept thinking, well, if I was that president and I was sitting there and all of a sudden the news came over that this guy I'd been fighting with was now the Pope of Catholics all over the world, whether I was going to be a happy camper. She did put out a release saying this is really a good thing.
But isn't it a good thing that you know this? I mean, the fact is, therefore, that journalists have covered the controversy.
The question is enough. If you read the stuff in the tabs, there was almost nothing that was in any way controversial about
I don't know. I thought this story had everything: sex, drama, the future of 1.2 billion people in the world, you know, gay cabal. It was great. I was ready to defend, cover everything. I was even interested in the smoke until last night Piers Morgan had Rick Santorum talking about the importance of this pope. what was that? That, I said, is over coverage.
Rick Santorum. Yeah. Continuing the tradition of failed politicians being analysts on cable news.
Well, he also has
like
Newt Gingrich. Yeah, Newt Gingrich was talking about the importance of the pope. I don't get it.
Well, you know, once there's a certain point at which I guess you become an expert on everything.
Apparently. And Newt Gingrich has reached that? Oh, dear.
Yeah, well, Rex and his editorial board are like that.
We do. We comment on everything, but we do such extensive research, of course, that we really know what we're writing about.
Well, then you should watch more about what we do here, Rex, and you'd have a better time of it.
Absolutely. What do you have there?
Well, this is a really interesting piece that has come out about Google Glass.
Oh,
and it's
cool.
Like, it's like we can all be Terminators now. You saw the movie where in his little head and his little robot brain, he can see into the future and click on news, and it's here. It's not anything in science fiction or the future anymore.
I saw a video of it a couple weeks ago when they were just first out, and it went viral, and suddenly you see these people who it is shot by where they look. So, Alan, basically, if you had, instead of the glasses you're now wearing, if you were wearing Google Glass, the video would be what you're looking at, me. And I would just be
hitting
your waving.
It would have a little chip on the side of your lens.
Yeah.
Instead
of
on your
shoulder.
And so
while you're looking ahead off to one side, you know, in your peripheral vision, you can see, like, the weather, the headlines.
Well, that's where we're heading.
No. We're here. That's the whole story.
Well, but now the question is adoption. How many people will, you know, take advantage? Google, of course, got into terrible trouble this week. On yet another subject, you know, they have these Google Street scenes, and apparently they were grabbing at the same time what everybody had said on their email if the email account wasn't password protected.
Yeah, they were.
And they had to apologize for that, and I think they're going to have to pay something.
They paid a $7 million fine, which is not for Google.
It's a drop in the bucket.
But the Google Glass is just, I think, an interim step. It still seems to me that there's going to come a point where we're going to have digital technology embedded into our bodies so that we can, you know, pull our left earlobe in order to activate a camera or something like that.
Right.
And of course, you know, it has implications for news, too, because you're just looking at headlines here. This is even shorter than 142 characters of tweeting. Mm-hmm. It's nothing. You get a headline as you're walking down the street.
Wow.
I don't think you should wear these while you're driving, by the way.
Well, I'm anxious to see who the first person will be who will get it in our community here. Who's going to have Google Glass here first? Mm-hmm. Probably our investigations editor, Bob Port. Bob is an early adopter of technology. That would be kind of an interesting thing. But it is true that as this technology emerges, we're finding that some people still cling to the old technology. There's a new study that says that male sports fans choose local print newspapers rather than TV, radio, or any other print outlets when asked to list all the sources from which they get their news information or analysis. This is why we still put out a sports section that doesn't draw any advertising revenue, with lots of pages of data in the what we call agate, the very tiny type. Sports fans, especially male sports fans, love that sports section.
So how come it doesn't get any advertising?
That's good question.
If you think all the men were reading it.
Yeah, why wouldn't you get advertising?
There's certainly some advertisers who want to cater to men. Why don't they go where the eyeballs are?
The tire sellers. Otherwise, buying decisions in households are made by women.
No, I get it. Mm-hmm. I get it, certainly in my household. And yet, there are some things that men want, like the generator I just bought, you know, for a lot of thousands of dollars, so that if our heat goes off, there's a generator. This was something that my wife opposed, I don't mind saying, and I did anyway. And today,
it's a guy thing. You want to have a nice big engine outside your house, right?
So that's right. So why don't generator? So why don't the generator people put their ads in the sports section?
Aren't men like children? They go, "Mommy, mommy, I want this."
Yeah. Well, if you looked at our house about who was spending what, I'll tell you right now, it wouldn't be Alan spending the most money. And
this is a good
thing.
This
is going to
generate. I trust Roselle's judgment. This is a good thing. But the fact is, I don't know. I've been annoyed for years that advertising doesn't sell in the sports section, but we still have to maintain it and give a lot of newsprint to it.
I read the same report, Rex. It's fascinating. And I also wondered why men do favor the newspaper. You know, why would they not go online where it's more up to date, you might think? Mm-hmm. Or
like I do.
Yeah.
Sports radio.
I'm obviously not a real man.
Sports radio or ESPN, which, you know, is just...
Well, they do all of that, but...
But mostly, yeah.
For news information or analysis, they say they go to the newspaper. And one of the interesting trends in sports coverage lately has been, of course, the much greater emphasis on women's sports. And that's really fascinating if you get into it. For example, one of the best storylines in our community has been girls basketball in the high school level.
Right.
And that's has been a great sports story this year to see which teams are going along. Let's hear it for the Flying Horses of Troy. And so this is a fun thing to see, but it is still primarily a men's venue in the paper, as opposed to the news, which is getting a heavier female emphasis as well. Kind of an interesting thing. By the way, more buyouts at USA Today, as well as at other newspapers, just a continuing indication of the trend of downsizing in print, as we're speaking.
It's amazing. You know, the downward spiral on newspapers continues, and yet the upward spiral, at least staying even on something like public radio, because maybe we're better at adapting to conditions than the newspapers are. What do you make of that, Rex?
Upward spiral?
Yeah, well, we have actually, you know, a couple of years ago, there was a major spate of stories about how commercial radio was actually losing listeners, some of the local right-wingers here in town, and public radio was either holding its own or going up.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I remember that.
See that?
Mm-hmm.
So the real question then is, how come newspapers, despite, you know, the pontificating on the part of the arrogance on the part of, you know, some of you guys who think you know everything, is that your industry is basically failing?
Well, actually, we have a bigger audience than we ever have. It's just that it is digital rather than print. So we're just not making as much money at it.
Then why are all these layoffs and other things?
Because we're not making as much money at it. Because digital doesn't produce as much revenue as print. The dollars per eyeball or per pair of eyeballs is dimes to dollars by comparison to print. And so that presents an economic challenge, but not a journalistic one.
It's interesting to me that one local publication continues to do well. Their circulation even increased, the Business Journal.
Did circulation increase?
Yes,
is that right?
And they've
really
built steady. They've got about the same cohort in their newsroom.
Is that because it's a niche publication?
I think so, yeah. They're very much aware of what their audience wants and delivers a really
well. Most people pay for it out of their businesses. They're not paid for by individual subscribers, like out of your household budget. It's paid for by your office. And that is the same thing with the Wall Street Journal. That's one of the things that sustains the circulation of the Wall Street Journal.
I don't understand, because, Rex, your newspaper does a terrific job of covering business. It does. Mm-hmm. So are you telling me that what we're doing is we are, even though you're, it's one of many things that you do and do well, that unless it's niche and it's all business, you know, you're going to lose out to the niche publications?
No, I think that that niche publications have a place. We recently began a magazine for women called Women at Work in Women in Business, when we found that of the women in jobs in the capital region, only 4% of them were reading the Business Review. And so we figured there's a niche that we need to get into. And that's why we created this magazine specifically targeting women in the professional positions. It's been very successful, both for events, which is one of the things that sustains niche publications, as opposed to the publications themselves. There's a lot of like breakfasts and
meetings and interactions.
Yeah, meetups, that
seminars,
kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's where a lot of the revenue comes from.
So the problem is in the general paper, the mass media, where and that's a loss for all of us, because you never pick up a newspaper and say, oh man, I really want to read about a juicy corruption scandal down at City Hall. You would see that article on your way to fashion or sports or something. And now we pick what we want to see ahead of time. So we're missing all the serendipity that came out
of
the old paper.
And what can you do about that? I knew.
if we knew, we wouldn't be sitting here in Albany.
I know. Well, I don't know.
Right.
We would be, because the Times Union with its new focus,
would be the center of the media universe, starting on the press in the week.
Wonderful new press that you're talking about.
Very exciting.
You're very proud of. The plus side on that new press, just for a moment, is that you're going to be able to do more. You're going to be able to have more color. You're going to be able to print for other people, you know, effectively. That's all good. But the downside is, if it doesn't work, somebody's going to be standing there with egg in their hands, right?
It'll work, because the savings in raw materials alone is going to pay for the press in the course of about 5 years. Because it uses plates that are much more environmentally friendly and are less expensive to create and consumes a little bit less newsprint. One of the interesting things is, because it's a sharper press, we don't have to use as much white space surrounding the photographs. Mm-hmm. We've had to put a lot of white space to set off our bad reproduction of photographs lately. So we can actually get better reproduction and more words on a page, even though the page itself is smaller and we're spending less on newsprint.
Well, it's a gutsy move, and we are here to congratulate you.
Okay, I have one. How is this? Smoke made question, and that is, what happens to the old press, that big huge thing? What happens to that?
Well, there's a nice guy who's going to come in and disassemble it, and he gets to keep the iron in exchange for us giving it to him. So he will scrap it. He will actually make some money from the scrap. Now, some of these old presses have been dumped into the sea to become coral reefs, interestingly enough, once they're cleaned.
Wow.
Used to be 15 years ago you could ship them off to Indonesia, where there was a market for old letterpress, and now that's been saturated. So there really is no place to take an old letterpress. It can be cleaned up and resold for scrap, and that is going to happen in a few months.
And in the 1930s, we were sending an awful lot of iron to Japan, which turned around to be a very bad move on our part, because the Japanese made weapons out of it.
See, this is why it's good to have a PhD in the room.
I just want to say to all my students, do you see what happens when you ask what seems like a stupid question? That was fascinating.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, that's really
interesting. This is one of the things that I've said to Alan, without meaning to just butter him up or anything. Alan is a great interviewer. I don't know how you do this, because I am not a good interviewer. I will sometimes sit there when somebody tells me something as a reporter, and I'll say, huh. And the person will say, why do you say that? So that becomes, okay, well, I was just saying, huh, because I was thinking of what my next question is. But Alan always knows what question to ask next. And I don't know quite how you do this, but you have a sort of curiosity. This is one of the things about Charlie Rose. He can do this.
I very quickly want to tell a story, if I may.
Please.
I did the best interview of my life last week at the Colonial Theater. And Deval Patrick and his wonderful wife, Diane, were there, and they proceeded to tell all about their lives, how they met, but under very difficult circumstances, how she had been threatened with a gun by her ex-husband and her struggles with depression. It was a fantastic interview, and I got back here, and they told me that the CD had been corrupted.
No.
Yes. So we were able to salvage it.
Oh.
But I mean,
he cut the story short after great effort.
No. It really was. It really was one of the worst sleepless nights I have ever had in my whole life.
That's terrible.
And I was saying to myself, who will tell the Patricks?
You got to come back and do it again, folks. So it is still there, and we're going
to
hear it.
Well, most of it is there. You will hear it, but a little bit has to be supplied by a narrative, you know, and then
Excellent.
She said, yeah.
It'll sound like it was intended to be that way all along. Well, we've reached the end of the program, folks, and we hope that you liked it well enough to come back again and hear more of Pete Seeger, at least, if not us.
I've even met a genius who swallows rattlesnakes. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people, like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ding-a-ling, ding-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people, when they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a...